We've been talking about calm abiding for a few days. Shamatha, settling the mind. So, a lot's been said for those just arriving, but a very brief recap. This is hard for me to do this kind of thing, right? To be brief, as you know. But these three aspects of calm abiding, I think, are really important. Of relaxation, first the foundation of body, relaxed breath, relaxed mind, relaxed, settled, abiding. We can scan awareness through the body if there's any tension, relax. If the mind is gripping some story, relax. Really the foundation. Shamatha means calm abiding. So this calmness is key. And then mindfulness or attention, which I've been speaking of, is particularly like we're paying attention to something. We actually have an object of meditation and being clear what that is. Just be present and aware is good, but without knowing what we're being mindful of specifically, then it very easily dissolves into some sort of undercurrent of thinking mind. So mindfulness is like the like a leash that ties the mind, which is like a restless, wandering ox, keeps eating other people's fields. Neighbors get upset. So we have this leash or this rope, and we tie it to a tree. We keep it, you know, loose around the collar. We don't want to strangle it. We want to be very kind to this ox, but we're training the ox to stay near this tree. And the tree is the object of meditation, such as the breath. The relaxed, deep breath filling the body. Or the object could be a wider object, like a giant sequoia that we tie this leash to. The breath is kind of like a small sapling. Giant sequoia, we can tie this giant rope around. And that wide object could be like the entirety of our present experience with all the senses open, eyes open in this kind of meditation, some visual input, some auditory input, some tactile input. So the present experience as object. But that's a very clear, specific object, I propose still. And just to nuance that a little bit, I think it's, and this is just in this laboratory of Sesshin, checking out the nuances myself, my feeling about this is it's not so much like actually moving from sensory object to sensory object, of like, there's a sound, okay, now it's the bodily sensation, I may have talked about it that way, but as I look more clearly, I think the most settling and clear object is like the kind of the sense of how all that is happening right now. So really like the presence of all that. Not so much focus on the details of the sound and the color, but like the immediacy of the experience, the now-ness. And then that brought up practicing with silence. And she said the silence, that the overall silence of the experience, which includes sound. So that's, I think, her creative way that, of talking about this unified field of experience. Would you say? Like that? Yeah, so it's like the silence that includes sound is not so much like, oh, there's that sound, I'm going over there, and now there's this here. It's like, it's actually the silence itself, the unified field. And I think that way it's very similar to presence. The present moment, the crest of this rolling wave, right on that crest called the present moment, that's rolling forward each moment, surfing that crest of that wave. Present, present, present. And then, you know, almost like peripherally, there's the sound of the kids playing. Here's the breath again. But the main object of focus is the presentness of it. This is you can play with that nuance. For me, that helps to make it very vivid, clear, simple, and one object that's not moving around too much, which is generally how these what's nice about trees is they're just planted and they don't move around too much. They're good. They're nice to tie axes to. So relaxation, mindfulness, and then I've been saying vigilance, and Ellen brought up maybe vigilance is a little too intense. We could get uptight being vigilant, maybe. So this again, we can nuance these words. Maybe diligence is another one, but it's the monitor that's watching to see if the rope has come untied. So it's working together with the mindfulness is the rope that's like keeping this wild ox from eating everybody else's fields. And you could say, that, well, I want to just leave it at that. Well, because ropes often come undone or oxes like chew through them. So the monitor called vigilance or diligence or alertness is just kind of like, it's like the farmer who's actually just relaxed sitting there in the field but keeping an eye on the rope. And as soon as it gets untied, just quickly walks over and reties it and sits back down. So these are all the aspects of the mind working together. Relaxation, mindfulness or attention to the object, and alertness. And I mentioned yesterday, I thought of this term sampajana that often goes with sati, being mindfulness. And they're often linked together, sati sampajana, or in Sanskrit, smriti samprajanya. And it means like clear comprehension. And I thought, well, that's maybe similar to this alertness, clearly comprehending as well as mindful. The Buddha often used these together. And but then I just, you know, came across this other term that maybe is even more fits the description of alertness. And it's again from this Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra. It's the classic mindfulness teaching of the Buddha. And the term is atapi. And it means like diligence or conscientiousness And again, they're often used together. As I recall, the sutra is something like, one's practicing mindfulness of the body in the body, and then there's these three as a link together. Mindful, ardent, and clearly comprehending. One practices mindfulness of body in the body. I think that's one translation. Mindful, ardent, and clearly comprehending. And so ardent would be like this atapi. And ardent, I think, means like warm actually. Yeah, and it's related to fire. And atapi is related to another word, tapas. Maybe yoga practitioners have heard of tapas. It's like a kind of heat, the heat of intense practice. I've seen like American yoga mats I think there's a company called Tapas Mats, trademark. It's kind of, but I think it like traditionally means like almost like ascetic practices in India. It often refers to like really like cooking. Tapas, so atapi is like ardent or alert, diligent, and then clear comprehending would be like just a really clear mind of what's happening. And it might even be that the clarity of the object, like for following the breath, we could speak of like, you know, each little sequence of the in-breath and out-breath, or if it's the field of present experience, and it's like that vivid sense of nowness, like we're right on the crest of that wave. And sometimes you can feel the difference right here, right? It's very hard to surf on that crest, right? Ardent, mindful, and clearly comprehending. And then I thought, yeah, maybe this atapi is closer to this diligence or alertness. And then I saw a definition of it. And I thought, oh yes. One definition is returning to the object of meditation as soon as it's lost. So there it is. I think that's the function of this monitor. Is just go over, retie the rope, return to the object of meditation as soon as it's lost. That's the function of atapi. So anyway, these three are working to create a calm, abiding, settled experience. And I heard once that Suzuki Roshi, he taught following the breath, and he taught Shikantaza. And I think there were lots of people practicing meditation with him, and maybe people were curious and trying to practice Shikantaza. And at some point, I think maybe he checked with people about what was happening, and he felt like, actually, people are just getting, their minds are wandering all over the place. Let's everybody at Zen Center just follow the breath now, or even count the breath, he might have said, for a year. I don't know, maybe it was near the end of his life and he didn't put a time limit and then he died. So that people may still be doing it. But something like that I heard, that he said, I'm asking everybody to do this practice now because I feel like maybe in the name of Shikantaza we're getting like distracted, or we're not ardent and clearly comprehending. And I also heard from his own mouth, Zoketsu Norman Fisher once tell this story, that when he was abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, he I think felt the responsibility to talk with everybody living there, at least at Green Gulch, about their practice. And kind of checking in about Zazen. And I think he spent a while like in Dokusan's going, to 50 people or so, like, how's your zazen? What are you actually doing in zazen? Like, let's talk about it, specifics. And after he did this kind of community survey, he reported to the community something like, there's an emergency happening here. Maybe he didn't say it like that, but he said, what I found was that people were, I don't know if they said it this way, but his interpretation was people are just spinning their wheels during zazen, as Norman put it. Actually, maybe they said, well, I'm just sitting. We say just sit, right? So I'm just sitting down, and I sit there, and, you know, stuff happens, and you know, it's relaxing. It's a nice way to start the day. Well, maybe he asked, well, you know, what's your object of meditation, or what are you doing? Just whatever happens. And I don't know, remember the details, but I think he said, people are spinning their wheels. We need to actually focus the mind here. So again, he, I think, proposed at that time, let's all go back to the breath. Some people were already doing that. Of course, sometimes when we're trying to follow the breath, our wheels are spinning a lot of the time, as we know. That's what they do. That's what they're used to doing. So we're training them to slow down. So I don't think I was maybe a wheel spinner, and I resisted that a little bit. It's so comfortable to let the wheels turn. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels go round and round. I really love to watch them roll. So I've been encouraging myself and all of us this session so far to, like, be really clear about what the object of meditation is. And I think we can expand it to this wider field of the present experience. We'll still call that an object. And as I mentioned briefly, therefore, many people would call that shikantaza. If you're ardent, clearly aware, and surfing the crest of the present moment wave, many people would call that shikantaza, I think. But I feel like there's more to the story still. It's not over yet. And my intention this session was to bring up this practice of turning the light around and shining back. And it's the third day, so if that's what the theme of the session is, a better start. So for those who missed the foundation, that was a summary of some of it. And we can practice that the rest of the session, attending to the object, mindful, ardent, and clearly comprehending. And we can experiment with different objects and consciously shift between them. I think even in the middle of zazen, to even clearly comprehend, on the next breath, I'm going to switch object from the breath to the wide field of experience. Instead of just like, well, let's just see what happens. And then the cow is like several blocks away. Call the police, try to track it down. We haven't seen it anywhere. Wait for the neighbors to call in their complaints. So this is another practice now. We could add in, and we can go back and forth, and as I've sometimes heard it taught, it's not like you're just doing one or the other all the time. This is like a little, like, if you're feeling really ardent and clear, then you can experiment with this. And I've been experimenting a little bit on and off, and again, I confess that, like, I sometimes feel, I don't know if I'm ready for this turning the light around right now. I don't want to make it too big a deal, because it's actually not such a big deal, but I think we need a strong foundation. I remember once Tassajara Tenshin Roshi, he might have been even teaching this practice, but I'm not sure. Sometimes he would like to present, like, you know, specific practices that we try on. And it might have been this one, or it might have been some other one, but something something new. And he brought up this cartoon that he came across. That was something like a picture of a dog looking at this, like a ring of fire. Somebody was holding a fire ring, and the dog was like perched, you know, like getting ready to jump. And the caption was something like Harriet, or whatever the dog's name. Harriet, you know, looked at the ring of fire with some excitement, but some trepidation, because after all, she was an old dog, and this was a new trick. You know that saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. So, I think in our case, old, we're not talking about age, we're talking about, like, habituated to certain kinds of practice. So, we like practicing, just being, and so this turning the light around thing is kind of like a new trick, and it's hard to learn when we're used to other ways. And our ways might be quite good, so we might not want to change. Just like that story in the Lotus Sutra, where the assembly of arhats, greatly realized practitioners, mindful, ardent, clearly comprehending arhats, who had realized that they had no self, they were free of suffering, abiding in nirvana even. And the Buddha said, I have a new teaching for the assembly today of the one vehicle. And you know that in the sutra, that 500 arhats actually at that point got up and left. Yeah, in the Lotus Sutra, the Buddha is about to teach the one vehicle that's the what the Lotus Sutra is the one vehicle. And all these arhats were like, well, actually, I'm going to go meditate now. I got my meditation practice. I'm already abiding in nirvana. So why would I need the one vehicle? So they left, and the Buddha said, well, that's okay. They can go. Those staying can now hear the teaching of the one vehicle. So, it's hard to teach old arhats new tricks. So, turning the light around, shining back. This is collection of teachings, of expressions of this turning the light around and shining back. And I collected it all years ago, and it's actually on the Zen Center website. It's a secret teaching there. No one bothered to download it because turning the light around, shining back. It's in the Dharma resources section. And but I recently thought, well, it wasn't really complete. I found many more expressions of this, and it made a bigger list, and I'll put it on the website, and I'll make copies for you all and put them back there in the work period. And if you want, even during this no reading session, if you want to look at this, it's very short, pithy, teachings on how to turn the light around and shine it back in like one or two sentences. And I just feel like these expressions, some of them don't use that phrase exactly, but I feel like these are all teaching the same kind of a specific practice, technique, we might even say, an art of Zazen. And Shakyamuni Buddha, the expressions I found teaching this, Bodhidharma, the first ancestor, the second ancestor, the third, the fourth, the fifth, and the sixth Chinese ancestors, found places where they're all teaching this, sounds like. And then a bunch of our later Chinese ancestors, Hongzhi, great Soto, Shirto, Yaoshan, our Soto ancestors, Dogen actually uses the phrase several times throughout his writings. Ejo, Keizan, and then some Korean Zen teachers, and a Taoist teacher, very specifically teaching the same thing, kind of Taoist influenced by Zen, that Richard will appreciate. And then I included some Tibetan teachers teaching the same thing as well. So it's not just some wacky, renegade, deviant, heretical teaching. It's like there it is all through our lineage. Kind of hidden maybe in there. So let's bring it out. Turning the light around and shining back is a phrase in Japanese, Ekko Hensho. And E means to turn, or to turn around, or to return. Ko is light. My name, Kokyo, is luminous owl. So it's that character. So, to turn the luminosity. And hen also means to return or go back. And sho means to shine, shining. So they're almost, the two halves are almost the same. To turn the light, or return the light, and to return the shining, or shine back. So turn the light around and shine back, I think is a nice, quite literal translation. Some people say to turn the light and shine within. The Fukan Zazengi in Dogen's Zazen instructions, he says, turn the light around and shine it back to illuminate yourself. Turn the light around to illuminate yourself. He maybe just says it like that. Turn the light around to illuminate yourself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away. So, technically speaking, there's in the Fukan Zazengi, self, there's no word for self in there. So I think this is the translator trying to explain. It's literally, is that what it is? Turn the light around to illuminate yourself.
Turn the backwards step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself.
Mm-hmm. Learn the backwards step. So this is a new trick called the backwards step we can learn. Turn the light around, shine it back. So it's a kind of poetic expression because the light we're talking about here is the light of awareness. The light that's like includes like this rope of that's tying the ox to the tree, the light of mindfulness, the light of attention that's radiating outward and meeting all these objects like the breath the light of awareness or consciousness or attention. We can look at how all those words might work for this. And that light is always, all day, directed outward towards objects. And we use it in meditation. Where it's directed outward towards objects, and like, it's usually like scattering all around, and it's radiating to all different objects. And in this kind of calm abiding, we're saying, now we're going to like focus the light on one object, or maybe one big object, but we're going to train it, to rope it in here to one object. So we're using the outward directed radiance of mind to calm the mind. So, which is a great practice, and already difficult enough, we might say. So now, this thing of turning the light around, we're going to reverse the awareness, the light of attention. And this is just an image to describe this quite subtle practice. Of kind of withdrawing the light, or instead of attending outward, to attend inward, to the source of actually the light. Look back at where the light's coming from. Awareness, looking back into awareness. The mind, looking back into the mind, or the source of mind. And sometimes I had heard these kind of things, just like look at the mind in a sort of vague way. But as I see more comments and teachings about this, I'm understanding it now as a quite specific practice, kind of a technique. And so we can go through some of these. Let's start with Shakyamuni Buddha. Who didn't use the term turn the light around and shine back, but I think this is the same. If you have a sense now of what that is, of attending, instead of attending to the object of even the present experience, even now, I would call now is still an object that we're attending to. So now we're going to like, what is aware of now? We're looking back and like, well, what is this that's actually paying attention to now? And, you know, if you try that right now, or if you tried it before, it's very strange, because the meditation can kind of fall apart a little bit, because you can't find what you're looking at anymore. It's hard enough to find now, right? But if you look back, well, who's aware of now? Huh? And if we think, oh, it's this particular thing, whatever, then that's probably not it, because it's not a particular thing. So that's why it's subtle and somewhat difficult. So Shakyamuni Buddha, in the Sandhi-Nirmochana Sutra, talks about, I think, this kind of practice that he's calling shamatha in this case. And I think as we go on, I can understand this, and I think there's some backup from other teachers that talk about there's some kind of way that shamatha and vipassana are actually coming together at this point. But in the sutra, he says, attentively meditate on the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. Attentively, carefully, with, you know, ardent and clearly comprehending, meditate not on an object, but on the inner stream of the meditating consciousness itself. What's attending here? That meditating consciousness is attending to the meditating consciousness. Attentively meditate on the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. That phrase in Chinese actually is like Nai Xin So, the inner, literally it's kind of like the inner mind, the characteristics or marks of the inner mind, which isn't quite as clear. So I think this is Thomas Cleary, I think is a nice way to put it. Attentively meditate on the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. Then a little few sentences later, same practice. Continually focus attention on meditation on the uninterrupted mind, the mind that focuses on images. So the uninterrupted mind is this consciousness that's just always flowing along, and it's the mind, it's uninterruptedly attending to images. So Buddha's here calling it the uninterrupted mind, this continuous awareness that focuses on images. Now we're going to focus attention on the uninterrupted mind, on the mind that focuses on images. Yes.
I was doing good up until that point. And just to share that, we'll see, you know, all the other things you have to say about this, but I was practicing with this morning, and I had a big shift because it really frustrated me in the past. You brought this up over the past years. And you even visually gone like this. And it's like, no! You know, there's something, I get stuck with this place, this mind. And it really, like, just like a wall. But, kind of, as a first step, experiencing full body awareness, not awareness of the body, but the body as aware.
Yes.
And then just like expanding out from the whole body, the awareness, so that it's not contained here either, kind of got me past my personal, like...
But was it, did it see, when you expand outward, does it then it seem external to your body somehow?
Kind of boundless.
Yeah, this is great. This is like the laboratory scientists at work. This is a great example.
But when you say the mind that attends to, what was it, objects? And it was like, that would think back to thinking of sight.
Yeah. I think this is a common thing. And so maybe that's a problem with this kind of image. Because I think part of the problem here is that we think that we and I don't know if this is because, this is an interesting point, I think. I don't know if this is because we're Americans, and modern Americans, that actually understand that mind and brain are closely connected. So it may, because like in Asia, when they say, where's your mind? They point here. Yeah, your mind is literally like in the body here, if you think of it in some place at all. And we often, I think of mind, but also because all the sense organs are collected in this area of the head, and they're connected with the mind. So I think that's part of it too. So if we're, and sometimes you can trace back the senses. And then it seems like this area of the head. So if we, which we may be an advantage of going to the awareness itself as opposed to the sense consciousnesses, but the mind consciousness, and try to disassociate that from the head, from the physical head and brain, because actually, and this is maybe a way that you did that by like body awareness. We see our mental awareness is actually not located in the head, and it helps, as we aware of the body, it helps bring it out of the head.
And like the intelligence in every cell,
Yeah. Well, part of this turning the light around is then to actually, and this would be the particularly Vipassana aspects. Vipassana is like the investigative insight questioning. It would be to like ask, and this is all now based on being really settled in this present open awareness, already very still, so the mind's not discursively thinking, but and to ask in this almost non-discursive way. If we get a lot of like, you know, here's my list of questions I'm going to ask the mind now, we lose the shamatha. So it's like this investigation, almost wordless investigation, but it's exploring, you know, who is this that's aware, actually? And one of the questions is traditionally used is, okay, you're looking for your mind now. We have these Zen stories about this. And one of the questions is, does it have a location? Oh yeah, it's in here because that's the brain. No, experientially, is it in there? Well, that's habitually I go there, but actually, when I'm really settled, maybe I experiment with different places where it might be. No, it's not there, and so it actually has no location. And this is part of this opening that starts to happen. So the Buddha says, attentively meditate on the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. Another translation, that's from the Chinese. As I say, they're using these characters for inner mind. The Tibetan, at this very dynamic point, we don't have the Sanskrit of the sutra, but we have a Chinese and Tibetan from the Sanskrit. The Tibetan's quite different. It says something like, attend to the mind that can be thought of by any mind. And that's related to the mind that can think of anything. Attend to this, almost like this universal mind that is the same when it's thought of by, like there's an angry mind here, right? And now it's looking back, that mind is the same for it. The source is the same. Now there's a really like loving mind, it looks back and it's the same. So the mind that can be thought of by an angry mind or a loving mind, and it's the same. It's a kind of clunky way of talking, but that's that same section. So this is Tenzin Roshi's commentary on the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra. This part here. And he links this into this phrase Ekko Hencho, turning the light around. I might not have noticed that if it weren't for him. But to tie it into this Zen teaching. And he just says, in practicing the instruction to turn the light around and shine it back, where he's talking about this section of the sutra, we make a transition from looking at objects and thinking about them to concentrating on the uninterrupted mind. This transition is potentially disorienting. So, in my experience, he says, it can be nauseating. So, same with Nanette. Same with, I find it also, when I've been playing with it, it's not some like easy little trick that you just do, oh yeah, here it is, the uninterrupted mind. I think it's like it's a different kind of thing than we're used to doing. We're used to directing the mind towards objects. We're not even so used to training the mind onto particular objects. That also takes a lot of diligence. But this is really tricky. That's why I think it's very helpful to I've spent a couple of days already just really training the mind in this other already kind of difficult way. And then when we're somewhat grounded, and you know, I don't think There's some question, maybe different people would agree, some would say, you really have to be in this really settled state of riding on the crest of nowness to do this effectively. And I think that may be like, it may be easier and more clearly transformative at that point. But I think there's room, and there's actually teachings about, you could even be quite distracted. Like there's some teachings of, while we're on, yes.
Okay, so suppose, you know, you're trying to get in this really relaxed space.
Yeah.
And then I feel like I'm being distracted by the project. And I'm being distracted by thinking I need to psychologically approach this project, which I thought spiritual practice was not about. About getting involved in psychological assessments is not where I want to go right now.
What's a psychological assessment?
I'm going to relate to somebody. Huh? I'm going to relate to another individual. This is about me waking up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm constantly engaging in how I'm going to relate to somebody and other people's baggage, I mean, I'm getting a lot of baggage as it goes now. Now I'm just accumulating a ton of baggage.
What do you mean, other people that you're thinking of?
Yeah, In the spiritual community, it's like there's negative seeds being planted, and I'm taking them on, I'm watering them, and you know they're very distracting. And so I try to not have that.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have it initially because I felt like I had a great relationship with everybody in the very beginning, and now I feel like it's just very distracting. Like I can't go forward. I can't progress. Mm. And it's no one's fault. I mean, I can see how it's a set of conditions created by many people, not just one.
Are you talking about this community?
Yeah, not just one person. Mm-hmm. There isn't one person creating this set of situations that's very distracting.
You feel like out of harmony with...
Well, I just don't understand. I mean, of course, I'm not where you are at, and I'm not where a lot of people in this room are at. I'm not there. So... You know, how do I get there?
Well, what kind of being out of accord with the community? I don't know if you want to mention anything specific, but...
I guess the sense that I have to... I'm not really sure. That's a good question. I think about it.
Yeah. And during Sesshin, you're feeling it? I mean, you're feeling like stuff's happening during Sesshin that you feel like is conflictive with other people?
No, it's just...
Or just from the past?
The project is coming up.
This meditation project? Yeah.
The project of people relating to each other on a spiritual level.
Hmm.
So I guess if it's a delusion, then I need to abandon it.
Mm.
It's probably something I could just use as a topic of meditation, is that this is a delusion.
I would say, rather, you know, I would suggest as an object of meditation to not, like, use the object of delusion to, like, focus on and try to work out or anything, but to actually, like, release it. And just come back to something very simple like the breath. That's actually it's not about other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really good to come back to the breath, but I do sense that people are trying to work something out. I mean,
but not with you, right?
I feel like I'm involved somehow, but maybe I'm not. Maybe I just not feel like I'm involved.
Well, if if I'm talking about here's some practices, you can get really involved in these practices, it's like... You don't have to do that, for one thing. And if other people are involved in working that out, they're not having a problem with you, not doing a different practice or something like that.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I'm just feeling agitated by just the sense that I see it going on or something. Maybe I just need to not be agitated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, everyone will always be practicing. Probably what everybody's working on in their own practice is going to be slightly different or even very different, right? So the nice thing about Sesshin is, like, we support each other by, like, keeping the outer retreat together, and then the inner retreat of, like, what each person's working on is such a private thing, right? And we're talking about it in talks, when you know, like this, as I've said in previous days, like, it's really, you know, what each person is doing, you have to find your own way. So if these talks seem like not so helpful or whatever, you don't have to practice in these ways. I'm just offering different ways to practice.
Yeah, no, I don't find the talks unhelpful.
Or something that you want to do too complicated or something.
Feel like I need to tie the ox to the, you know, the thing. I don't need to do that. I just need to watch the broth.
That was my metaphor.
I have no problem with, but you know, I mean, that's obvious. But
maybe you misunderstood the metaphor, because that's what it was. The rope is in the. It's just a metaphor that the rope is mindfulness, the tree is the breath, and the ox is the mind that's wandering off. So,
I think I do have a problem with that metaphor because you've used it before with the dog tied to the wall. I'm not sure why. I have to meditate on that.
It could be because it sounds too controlling. Yeah, like we don't want to tie down the mind, which I think it could be seen like a problem with that metaphor. It's a little bit like, well, let's give it some more space. Like Suzuki Yoshi says, give your cows a large pasture. So maybe that works better for you. I would say
we could.
It's just emphasizing being really clear and alert. And training the mind like this. But if we get during Zazen, if we get so like, I'm really working on this, I'm really making an effort, this happens to me, right? I'm doing this and I'm starting to feel like tired or a little bit tense because I'm making so much effort and there's no success. And then I think at that time, that's when we bring in the relaxation part. It's like, let's just abandon this, because relaxation, if we're not relaxed, nothing's gonna actually help anyway. So we come back to just let it all go and just, okay, just let's forget, let's just like untie the leash for a little while and let this cow go wander around for a little while. And then we're like, okay, now I feel really relaxed again. Now let's come back to the breath, which is the cow. I know the breath is the tree, right? And, start this effort again. So another nice metaphor that the Buddha brought up about this kind of issue is like tuning the lute. Maybe, have you heard this one? The classic kind of meditation instructions that relates to this. Like one of the Buddha's students was making this great effort, and he was in a lot of pain and getting really exhausted and saying it doesn't work. And the Buddha said, okay, so before you were a monk, you were a musician, right? He said, yeah. When you were a musician and you were playing the lute, or we might say guitar, if you tune the strings too tight, what happens? Well, if you tune them too tight, they would just snap, actually. And then there's no music at all. And what happens if you tune them too loose? Well, then they're just hanging there. And there's no music either. And so it's this tuning where it's just right, so you get this beautiful tuned harmony. It's like the middle way. So if we're starting to feel like too stressed and like it's too much work and we're getting tired, this can happen. Then we're tuning the strings too tight, maybe. And then maybe about snap would be like, forget it, I'm out of here. And then too loose is like, well, then just like back to just like I just sit here and pass the days, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. Okay, is it over? Okay, it's over. And then we didn't play a song either.
I can imagine the feeling of nausea and disorientation. That's come from this, like, ability to, we're talking a lot about doing, applying effort.
Mm-hmm.
And then also living in a world where we don't do anything. I think the mind freaks out if it comes anywhere close to I think the mind is always trying to find a way to grasp reality, and there is perception and there is direction, maybe. I don't even know what the words are. But it's
the light.
Mm-hmm. How do you interact with something that's not graspable? Or interacting,
Yeah.
I can imagine all of this is like getting up close to the edge and just like, no.
And those very questions are part of the investigation. Those are great questions.
Yeah.
How do you interact with something that's ungraspable?
Yeah.
That would be like a kind of Vipassana sort of question.
Yeah. And ultimately the question is like, what am I experiencing or perceiving when there's some sense that just like, no, I'd rather sink back into just like a very kind of confined little picture of got the head, got the brain, got Thursdays and Friday, go back into
Yeah. And even now, even the present moment is a wonderful thing to get, special thing we get sometimes during sesshin of like, oh, I feel really present and clear. I'm usually more scattered, but even that's more comfortable than this place that actually isn't now anymore. It doesn't have any time. Now is still a kind of a time. This is beyond, sometimes said, past, present, and future, the timeless awareness. So, disorienting. And could we, nauseous, I don't know about, literally, like you feel sick to your stomach, if you meant that. But I think, can we have fun with such an experiment? After a couple of days in the lab, can we actually start playing like, whoa, this is, I just lost, okay, forget it. And like, but that was a nice try, a nice kind of like, I'm enjoying playing, I'm enjoying the disorientation, and I'm losing my mindfulness, so now I'm going to come back, and why would I want to do that anyway? Here's a list of 20 ancestors that are recommending this. I don't know why. So, yes.
When Kim mentioned delusion, what it brought up for me right away was the stories that we carry with us. All of our interactions kind of create stories. And, maybe this is kind of simplistic, but I've been working for quite a while now on trying to drop the stories, which means dropping the judgments. And that's difficult too, but realizing that we live in our stories. We create a lot of what happens with interactions and what happens in our thinking. The stories just kind of keep rolling out, and sometimes they're not very helpful because there's a lot of judgment with the stories. And so continually trying to drop the judgments or noticing, I've really got judgments about this. Can I drop that story? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of trying to simplify a little bit also when you were talking about kind of the philosophical base, you know, and how complicated everything becomes, simplifying, noticing, dropping the story as much as you can, you know, that might be helpful. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I have to. I mean, there's no other way I'm going to move forward if I drop the story.
Also, stories about.
I can't wait for the story to conclude.
This is a great point, actually, and it reminds me of I think an important issue in talking about this calm abiding shamatha. Because I've been this session focusing, talking about, you know, these things that we're doing, like this leash metaphor and stuff, is kind of like, here's what we're attending to this object. But actually, my teacher once pointed this out, and it was like a revelation for me. He's like, people often think that when we're talking about calming the mind here, that if staying with the object, you know, keeping this leash tied, is what calms the mind. But he's like, that's actually just actually a kind of a tool to help. But actually what calms the mind is letting go of everything but the object, letting go of all the distractions from that aren't about what's happening right now, or the stories, the stories about other things. So when we're talking about staying with the object, that's kind of a technique, but to help let go of the other stuff. But I think to talk about it as, because I think if you say just let go of everything, but there's nothing that you're focused, no object, then that's hard, but maybe possible. It tends to maybe get in, then we let go of something and we wander into something else if there's no anchor. But actually the letting go is the key thing. And actually the calming, you could maybe say, concentrating the mind is really fueled by staying with the object, but calming the mind, which is what shamatha means, is calm, abiding, really relaxed. That happens not so much from concentrating. That happens from releasing the, you know, stories. So that's so you might, if we're getting too caught up in focus, maybe like release the focus more and just notice the stories, anything other than my present experience right now, as simple as it can be, like this breath, and anything else is let go, and then we were settle. Yes.
Also from Rab, a suggestion that in a kind of peacefulness you can get in counting the breath can be from the mind just has a, the train stops, it kind of stops the train of thought. But it's amazing how you can be counting the breath and feel these little fragments of story.
Yeah.
They just kind of hang in mid-air, you know, but they kind of get it broken.
Yeah.
And so the whole train of thought can kind of just start breaking up, you know.
Not successful
in kind of reestablishing itself.
That's a nice image. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The mind so wants to get into that story and conclude it, like you say. I think that's what my storytelling mind wants. Well, let me just finish this one. Like maybe I can resolve it, and it's kind of like, but it's endless. There's no way to ever resolve any story ultimately, actually, from a deep perspective. So then this thing of like, but no, just two, but, and then they three, just yeah, break the train. Oh, Ellen.
I want to get back to this nauseous.
Yes.
You know, at first I thought the existentialists were the only ones who talked about nausea. Because it's something that I relate to. And it comes over me. It's not a feeling of sickness in the stomach. It's almost like my whole being what makes puts me in that state, whether it's a, I don't know what consciousness.
But maybe it happens when you're sitting a lot. I think you can start to open to things like your own death.
It doesn't happen necessarily when I'm sitting.
Oh,
it happens at any
could be any time.
Yeah.
Interesting, though. Yeah, that, you know, about our own death is a little bit like, it could be related to this kind of like vast, ungraspable ocean, right? And it's like, you mean, I think sometimes you can get in just conceptually think about, what is it, when I die, that means like there's no more me, actually. If you start to really contemplate that, it gets that way, right? If you really start thinking about what that means to die.
And I don't try to do this, you know, it's like all of a sudden, I don't know, something happens, I'll be doing something, and then, I don't know whether things drop away and I become aware of it.
Yeah. Maybe it's your Buddha nature just knocking at the door, saying, remember, your life is not just this little thing that you think it is day to day. It's something really huge. And it's then it's kind of nauseating and it's disorienting maybe.
Yeah, scary.
Scary, yeah. So that's part of why often I think of doing this not just randomly, but when we're really grounded in shamatha, or you know, somewhat calm, stable. We're already getting in this practice of just calming the mind in general. We're getting really familiar with all our stories and how the mind's working, and we're seeing all our, oh, I really get caught up in this, and that, oh wow, that one took like a whole period to release, and like this and this. We're just getting intimate with ourselves and getting calm and grounded, and that whole strong foundation then maybe lets us more, okay, now we're really ready to pull out the ground, maybe a little bit more. So that's why Tsushin's a nice time to bring this up. Yeah, let's see more. Stan?
Just a real short thing that I sometimes remember to do with something that makes sense. And something that gets really strong and I want to let it go, I'll say to myself, how loud, tiny, no, thank you, not now. And that seems to help sometimes.
Yeah, simple techniques help me.
Yeah,
and I kind of feel like if I can just come back to all the simple techniques and do the meditation, that then later on, the other stuff will just get worked out because that's what the meditation is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I mean, the whole idea of
my pain
is to just not use the mind for a long period of time.
Well, not use the conceptual thinking.
Yeah, the conceptual thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The mind, the kind of non-conceptual and experiential aspects of the mind are more tuned up, maybe, and then but the storytelling, conceptual, discursive part of the mind, we're like we're letting go of again and again. That's what shamatha. That's what the breath is for. Actually, is because it's this thing that has no. Maybe there's a little bit of story around the breath, but not much. It's not very exciting stories about the breath. So that's why it's nice. It's very simple. And what Stan said reminds me of Suzuki Roshi's thing, like, you know, like when, something like when guests come, you can, you know, welcome and greet them, but don't invite them in for tea.
Yes.
Something like that. Like a thought arises and you don't slam the door in the face of the thought. You say, hi, how are you doing? I came for a tea party. Well, actually,
not now.
Not now. I'm hanging out here with my guest, my special guest, the breath, and this guest is from out of town, and they don't visit that often. I hang out with you all the time. I'm having a very quiet tea party with the breath.
Everyone's
asked. Oh yeah, entryway.
And if you're not invited for tea, the person who lives in the house will just talk to them again. Then they have to serve tea.
Oh. So you keep that boundary.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
This is Ken MacLeod, who's a Tibetan teacher, and talking about they have almost identical practice. It's uncanny that they talk about in different words in Tibetan traditions, and later if we have time on subsequent days we can read some of his very practical instructions. And he's talking about it as insight practice and says, similarly, this part about confusion and disorientation, he says, initially, insight practice is very confusing. You feel as if you're staring into nothing and you have no idea what you're doing. You probably have felt the same way in other practices, but insight practice amplifies these feelings considerably. In my retreat training, the whole group of us spent a peaceful and enjoyable month cultivating attention and calm abiding in preparation for this insight. Then we received these instructions, which is very much like turning the light around that he says here. And we all felt as if bombs had gone off inside us. So there you go. It's the usual. And he says, a month, by the way, is not a long preparation period to be maybe in retreat. They're doing like shamatha practice, like a month-long sesshin of shamatha maybe before this, right? One Tibetan teacher required to cultivate this stable attention day and night for 3 years before his teacher gave him instruction in turning the light around. So maybe this isn't appropriate. For this, on the third day of sesshin. then in that way you can hear it as like some kind of like special high-tech instruction. But again, I just wanted to mention, it's getting late, but this one thing to hear, like, you can do this, it doesn't have to be after 3 years of calm abiding practice. You can do it when you're totally, totally anxious and confused in the Zen tradition. Here's one example. There's a nice section of, this is Thomas Cleary's Shobo Genzo introduction, where he, I think, is the most thorough exposition of turning the light around and shining back with lots of different Zen examples. And he says it's his own personal practice, Thomas Cleary, or has been, was for years anyway. This one. Here's one. A monk asks Guishan? Isan, I think it's Guishan. What is the way? Isan said, no mind is the way. The monk said, I don't understand. And Isan said, you should understand that which doesn't understand. So, I'm confused, I don't understand. Look back to the one who's confused and doesn't understand. The monk said, or Isan said, Yisun said, you should understand that which doesn't understand. The monk asked, what is it which doesn't understand? Yisun said, just you are it. It's not someone else. Yisun said, people of the present time should just directly realize that which doesn't understand. This indeed is your mind. This indeed is your Buddha. If you externally get a piece of knowledge and a piece of understanding and consider that the path of Zen, you're out of touch. We should understand that which doesn't understand. And, you know, when the emperor asked Bodhidharma, who is this facing me? I picture it, he's like, he's always doing this practice, turning the light around. Who is this facing me? I don't know, actually. I don't know, I can't find anybody here when I look. It's kind of like, wow, the emperor just gave me some meditation instruction. Who is this? I don't know. Yeah, like, I got to work on this for 6 years. And just here's another one where it's at, where you don't have to be, have some like really stable foundation and calm. A monk asked, Shijo, whenever I sit at night, my thoughts are in a flurry and I don't know how to subdue them. Please give me some guidance. Whenever I sit during the daytime, my thoughts are in a flurry. I'm thinking about all these stories. I don't know how to subdue them. Please give me some guidance. She just said, when you sit still and your thoughts are in a flurry, then use the flurried mind to investigate the place of the flurry. Investigating this thoroughly, you find there is no place. Then how can the flurry of thoughts remain? Turn back to investigate the investigating mind. Then where is the mind which can investigate? So this is like maybe like a second step. Oh, so I like, go back to the place of flurry. Like, where is all this flurry coming from? Where are all these stories coming from? Look back, back. Not here, actually. Back, back, back. No direction, back, right? I can't find any place they come from. Now, who's doing this meditation of looking back? That's what I hear this as. The one, turn back to investigate the investigating mind. Where is the mind which can investigate? Furthermore, the perceiving knowledge is fundamentally empty, so the object focused on is also quiescent. So, sometimes we talk about meditation on emptiness. Sounds like a very lofty practice and realization. But in the simplicity of the Zen school and other simple practice schools, this type of practice could be called, like, if we're really doing this, turning the light around, shining back, is a kind of meditation on emptiness. Because you really can't find your mind, and yet it's not nothing. It's definitely not nothing. Because the light is radiantly shining, and that's why we're experiencing our life. But when we look for what is this light, we can't locate it or get a hold of it in any way. May the positive energy gathered here, if there's any floating around, may be directed toward all beings everywhere. May they receive this gift and settle into the present, letting go of everything else. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.